This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, March 16, 2012. In Kansas City, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up, a Ugandan gay rights group files a case against an evangelical author in a US court for his alleged role in measures that persecute gays. In Mexico, a prominent environmental activist who campaigned against a Canadian-owned silver mine is murdered in a highway ambush. And we'll preview the upcoming Supreme Court case testing the constitutionality of President Obama's healthcare law. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. A New Jersey Superior Court jury today convicted Darren Ravi, the former roommate of a gay Rutgers student, on counts of invasion of privacy and bias intimidation based on sexual orientation, a hate crime. Tyler Clementi committed suicide after Ravi set up a webcam in his dorm room. Ravi broadcast video of Clementi kissing another man to fellow students. Ravi faces up to 10 years in jail, according to the AP, and possible deportation to India, where he is a citizen. Ravi's sentencing is scheduled for May. The U.S. is transferring the soldier accused of massacring 16 Afghan civilians back to the United States today. Calls continue in Afghanistan for the U.S. to turn over the man to local authorities. Seattle lawyer John Henry Brown is representing the soldier, who is stationed at Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Washington State. He spoke to press on Thursday.
He was told that he was not going to be redeployed. The family was counting on him not being redeployed. And so he and the family were told that his tours in the Middle East were over, and then literally overnight that changed. So I think that it would be fair to say that he and the family were not happy that he was going back.
Brown said the soldier, who has not been identified, snapped under stress. The lawyer says he has not had an in-depth discussion with his client about what happened because, quote, we don't trust the phones. The situation is calmer today in southeastern Peru, where wildcat miners have been clashing with police for much of the week. Protest leaders will reportedly sit down with the government on Monday for talks about new rules cracking down on independent gold miners. The number of these miners has exploded recently as the price of gold has risen, and environmental impacts like mercury pollution and rainforest destruction have followed. Three people died in protests this week. Human rights groups say a couple in India were subject to torture at the hands of West Bengal police, a practice activists say is widespread throughout the country. FSRN's Shurya Niazi reports.
The group Bangalar Manabadhikar Suraksha Manch, an NGO based in West Bengal, has alleged brutal custodial torture of a couple by police in the state. In early February, police launched a late-night raid on the home of Firoz Ahmed and his wife Ajma Bibi. The human rights group says police did not present a warrant for entry and the two were beaten severely. Firoz was left unable to stand or walk. Police then took Firoz to the station. When his family was eventually allowed to visit, they discovered he had broken fingers and was not given medical treatment. Firoz was eventually accused on narcotics charges. The Asian Human Rights Commission says reports of police torture are common in India. The group says more than 14,000 people have died in police custody in the past decade. Just this week, a Communist Party leader alleged in court that he and others had been tortured and forced to sign blank pieces while in police custody. Shuranyazi, FSRN, India.
An anti-police brutality protest in Montreal yesterday resulted in property damage, injuries, and about 200 arrests. The annual protest attracted about 1,000 people, many students, according to local media. One witness, writing on the blog Rabble, said police fired flash grenades and tear gas canisters into peaceful crowds of people. International online protests have erupted on behalf of a Moroccan girl who killed herself after being ordered by a judge to marry her rapist. International media report 16-year-old Amina Filali had also complained of being beaten by her husband. She swallowed rat poison. Women's rights groups in Morocco are pushing for the law that allows such marriages, Article 475, to be scrapped. Protests are planned for tomorrow. Archaeologists in Uruguay have uncovered the remains of a body believed to be a victim of the country's former military dictatorship. It's the second set of remains found at an army base near the capital. For FSRN, Manuela Aldave reports.
The military dictatorship ruled Uruguay from 1973 to 1984, and in that period, thousands were arrested and imprisoned. Some people were disappeared, and their remains have been never found. On Thursday, a team of forensic archaeologists undertook the remains of a body at an army base on the outskirts of Montevideo. They have been searching the site for more than 5 years for victims of the dictatorship. This is the second body the scientists have discovered. Last October, they found the remains of trade union activist Julio Castro, who disappeared in 1977. Studies of Castro's bones show with evidence of torture and that he was shot on the head. An estimated 7,000 political prisoners were held during military rule. About 200 were killed. Today, Uruguayan President José Mujica visited a grave site, and a human rights organization is expected to do the same. No identification has been made on the body. Manuela Aldave, Free Speech Radio News, Montevideo.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood, in Kansas City. In Oaxaca, Mexico, a well-known environmental activist was murdered Thursday night in a highway ambush near his hometown. Bernardo Vázquez Sánchez has been leading a campaign against the Canadian-owned Fortuna silver mine in San José del Progreso, southeast of Mexico City. Shannon Young reports.
32-year-old Bernardo Vázquez Sánchez, a vocal opponent to a Canadian-owned mining project, was shot multiple times in the chest when armed men ambushed his car along a highway which connects his hometown of San José del Progreso to the regional hub of Ocotlán. His brother, Andrés Vázquez, and his cousin, Rosalinda Dionisio, both active in the local struggle against the mine, have been hospitalized with gunshot wounds. Bernardo Vázquez died upon arrival at a regional clinic. The men responsible for the attack have not been identified, but the organization Vasquez led, the Coordinating Committee of the United Towns of the Valley, has meticulously documented the actions of a group they say has been funded and armed by mining interests. In a recent interview with FSRN, Bernardo Vázquez Sánchez described how in 2006, the then-mayor of San José del Progreso signed a deal with mining company representatives without consulting the town's residents.
Nos dimos cuenta hasta el 2008. El 2008 prácticamente fue un año de exigencia al presidente municipal, pero
we found out about it in 2008. That year was marked by demands and peaceful protests against the mayor. In 2009, with the occupation of the mine, the pressure became more notable. And it was in May of 2009 when we found out about the pro-mine organization. And it was that month when we began to see armed men who belonged to said organization. Now, those armed men who belong to that organization are now part of the town governing council, and they've now brought in guys from other towns to act as their gunmen.
The mine in San José del Progreso operates as Minera Cuscatlán, a subsidiary of Vancouver-based Fortuna Silver. Bernardo Vázquez showed FSRN a case file of documentation, including photographs of men with weapons reserved exclusively for military use. His group had identified the men by name and, in the face of state government inaction, had planned to deliver the evidence to the Canadian embassy. While opposition to the mining project is a main thrust of the Coordinating Committee of the United Towns of the Valley, it's part of a larger set of demands for greater self-determination and territorial control in Oaxaca, Mexico's most indigenous state. Again, Bernardo Vázquez Sánchez.
The problem with the San José mine isn't just limited to San José del Progreso. It's a problem for Oaxaca. It's a nationwide problem. It's practically a war declared on the small towns and their people because government officials, in their eagerness to look productive, are giving away our gold like in times past.
The gold and silver mine in San José began full operations in September 2011. On its website, Fortuna Silver states it expects the mine to produce 1.7 million ounces of silver and 15,000 ounces of gold this year. Although opposition to the mine will likely continue, Thursday night's murder of Bernardo Vázquez Sánchez means local movements of mostly indigenous small farmers in the Ocotlán Valley have lost a young and committed leader. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
A Ugandan gay rights group is using the US court system to sue American author and evangelical leader Scott Lively, who's connected to anti-gay measures abroad. Those measures include a bill that calls for the death penalty against LGBT Ugandans. Anti-gay sentiment in Uganda has caused considerable unrest, including the killing of gay rights activist David Kato last year. The New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights filed the lawsuit Wednesday on behalf of Sexual Minorities Uganda in a court in Springfield, Massachusetts, where Scott Lively resides. The case was filed under the Alien Tort Statute, a law that allows foreign nationals to pursue legal action for human rights abuses in U.S. courts. Lawyers say while the law is often used for cases involving foreign nationals, this is the first case focusing on persecution of LGBT people. The lawsuit could lead to Lively being put on trial. For more, we're joined by the staff attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights, Pam Spees. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks for having me.
Firstly, who is Scott Lively and why exactly is he named in this lawsuit?
Scott Lively is an attorney and an evangelical minister and an anti-gay campaigner, basically, who's been working, you know, against LGBT rights and recognition for at least the last 20 years. He is named in the suit, which we brought on behalf of Sexual Minorities Uganda, for his role in the persecution of the LGBT community in Uganda. He has a very detailed plan. Basically, the end goal is to strip LGBT people of fundamental rights to speech, association, and assembly is a key piece of his platform. And he consults and works with other, it's a mix of government officials, politicians, and religious leaders in order to further that agenda and strip those rights.
So in terms of putting this case under the Alien Tort Statute, what is the basis of your case?
The Alien Tort Statute allows claims by non-citizens in U.S. courts for violations of international law. It's not unusual for a non-citizen to access U.S. courts for torts. If someone is in a car accident in France and the defective parts of the car were made by a U.S. corporation, those people can sue in the U.S. So it's not uncommon, but the Alien Tort Statute, what it does is gives access to courts for violations of international law as opposed to the usual tort claims like negligence and wrongful death. And, you know, I just want to say this. He is responding by saying that he's just exercising his right to free speech and expressing his religious beliefs. And in fact, our case would be actually easier to discuss and illustrate if we didn't have his outrageous speech out there to contend with, because even if we didn't have the examples of his speech where he calls gays genocidal and pedophilic and all of that, his underlying conduct is still illegal and persecutory. And we feel like we have a really strong case that links him to these efforts.
What sort of arguments against using the Alien Tort Statute will you be needing to counter?
I think he will try to assert that LGBT people should not have the same rights. He has theories that he uses to promote, you know, the stripping of these rights, which have to do with this alleged propensity toward mass violence and child sexual violence and that sort of thing, and that LGBT persons are not a group with a cognizable identity as other groups. I think that's something he'll raise and we'll have to counter. And so basically it becomes an effort in asserting their humanity.
David Bahati is a Ugandan politician who's been behind this proposed anti-gay legislation in that country. A previous draft of that legislation proposed the death penalty for LGBT people. He's also a member of a group called The Family that's based in the US. Can you tell us a little bit more about this group and the US connections with Uganda's push for anti-gay laws?
Their connection to the push for the anti-gay laws is a bit mysterious. But what they are essentially is a tight-knit evangelical network of high-level politicians and officials. They do trainings and David Bahati spent some time in D.C. and spent a lot of time with a family offshoot there. They long ago established a relationship with the Museveni government. So they're you know, they're very well connected into Uganda and David Bahati. And, you know, they're also behind the prayer breakfast here in the U.S. They were sort of, it was the family network that we now know was so instrumental to pushing that. So they do similar things, the family cells, I guess, for lack of a better word, in the Ugandan parliament will do similar things, have the same kinds of prayer breakfasts, prayer meetings. So they're connected into this larger network. Now, the family spokespeople for the family here in the U.S. have distanced themselves from Bahati's efforts and from the bill, as opposed to Scott Lively, who's been very clear about the agenda and how you go about methodically to get there to the end goal, which is silencing the LGBT community.
At what stage is this anti-gay bill at the moment in Uganda, and what exactly is being proposed now?
Actually, the same bill has been reintroduced. It was reintroduced in February, and it still has the language about the death penalty. It's in Legal and Parliamentary Affairs Committee, and it's expected that it will undergo some changes, and it may very well be that the death penalty comes out. But the criminalization of advocacy will remain, and the criminalization of those who fail to report others they suspect of being homosexual will likely remain.
What are the next steps in this U.S. federal lawsuit against Lively's role in Uganda's anti-gay legislation?
He will either have to answer the complaint or move that it be dismissed, in which case there will be argument about that. And then if we get past that stage, there will be, discovery processes and an attempt to gather more evidence and identify witnesses. And who knows what we'll be able to find through that process. And then hopefully we'll see a trial before a jury at some point.
Pam Spees, staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. Thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
The legal and political battle over President Obama's health care overhaul is heating up as the Supreme Court prepares to hear arguments about the constitutionality of the law later this month. With many of the Act's provisions under fire, new polls show the public is sharply divided along partisan lines on whether the court should strike it down, even though many don't understand how the Affordable Care Act affects them. A federal report released this week sheds more light on who could gain or lose health insurance under the law. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more in Washington, D.C.
If the Supreme Court upholds the Affordable Care Act, an estimated 3 to 5 million Americans could lose their employer-based health insurance, but many more would become eligible for subsidized care through Medicaid, insurance exchanges, and other programs. This is according to the latest study by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, which warns they can't accurately predict what employers will do when all the incentives and penalties in the law take effect in 2014. Even so, the CBO says the overall effect of the legislation is that 30 million uninsured Americans will gain health care coverage. Simon Lazarus with the National Senior Citizens Law Center says moving away from employer-based health care may not be such a bad thing, given the other options the Affordable Care Act provides.
All of us who are covered by such plans know that if we lose our job, everyone knows they're just one step away from being thrown to the wolves of the individual insurance market.
The U.S. Supreme Court will soon begin weighing several legal challenges to the Affordable Care Act and could strike down key provisions some say are unconstitutional. Most at risk is the individual mandate, the requirement that everyone not already insured either purchase an insurance plan or pay a penalty. Lazarus submitted an amicus brief to the Supreme Court on behalf of disability rights groups, arguing the rest of the law can't function without the individual mandate.
People who don't get insurance who could afford it are, in effect, betting with other people's money that they'll stay healthy. And if they lose, they'll go to the emergency room. They won't be able to pay their bills, and everybody else will end up paying for their costs.
If the Supreme Court strikes down the individual mandate, but upholds the rest of the law, as a lower court did, Lazarus says we'd be stuck with what he calls a death spiral.
once people understand that they will be able to get insurance after they get sick or after they get hit by a bus, then many more of them than is currently the case are going to say to themselves, well, guess what? I think I won't bother to pay for insurance now. I'll just wait until I actually get sick. The population of people who have insurance will get sicker. Therefore, the cost of insurance will go up. And that, in turn, will drive more healthy people who think they can beat the system by not insuring. That will drive more of them to drop their insurance, which will, in turn, drive insurance premiums up more.
Another challenged provision of the Act requires states to cover more people in their Medicaid programs or have federal funding withheld. Many Republican governors and attorneys general say this violates states' rights. Though many of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act haven't yet gone into effect, Ethan Rome with Healthcare for America Now says the law is already causing sweeping positive changes.
We're already seeing millions of people, seniors getting prescription drug discounts, young people able to stay in their parents' plans, and all of us with insurance no longer having lifetime limits. And we're already seeing rates coming down thanks to holding insurance companies accountable. So this law is already making an enormous difference in people's lives.
When the law has its second birthday next week, Rome and other healthcare advocates will hold events in Washington and across the country, calling on the Supreme Court to uphold the Affordable Care Act.
Under the new law, insurance companies can no longer deny you coverage just because you're sick. They can't dump you when you're sick. So we're talking about an entirely new system.
But as organizations both for and against the Affordable Care Act rally their supporters ahead of the Supreme Court arguments, a recent poll shows that public understanding of the case remains low. Liz Hamill with the Kaiser Foundation explained the results of the study.
We find even 2 years after the law has passed, 6 in 10 people say they don't have enough information about it to know how it's going to impact them. And 14% think it's already been overturned by the Supreme Court already, and 28% aren't sure.
Hamill says young adults, those with lower incomes and lower education and political independence, were most likely to misunderstand the law and its legal status. The nation's high court will hear arguments on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act later this month. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Protests against education cuts continue across the country, and in one California community, high school students are using a centuries-old nonviolent tactic, the hunger strike. From San Leandro, FSRN's George Lavender reports.
Last week, the San Leandro School Board voted unanimously to cut the school budget for the fifth year in a row. Almost $1.5 million in cuts threaten more than 50 jobs. Librarians and school counselors are hardest hit. The cutbacks were a step too far for many in the community. After the board's vote, three students from San Leandro High School announced they would begin a hunger strike.
I wanted to do it to connect with the school board members. You know, you see me and you see that I'm starving, but that's exactly how the students will be next year, with the budget.
Veronica Manduhano is a senior at San Leandro High, which could lose all of its sports classes. The school board said there just isn't the money for classes, but Manduhano doesn't buy that.
I think it's an excuse that people have been taking for far too long. You know, everybody knows that California is incredibly wealthy, and yet there is no money for PE classes, and there is no money for art classes, and that's just a sick joke.
Manduhano and her fellow hunger strikers wanted to bring attention to cuts to education, and it seems to have worked. At a packed meeting of the school board, students, staff, and community members asked the board to use its reserve funds to cover the budget shortfall, instead of cutting jobs and classes. Among those who spoke at the meeting was Erica Virey Santos, who teaches all three of the hunger strikers.
I definitely am hoping that people are being inspired by what these young ladies are doing. I'm hoping to see a lot more school districts and state governments and federal governments just being a lot more transparent with their decision making and everything that they're doing. I feel like that's what we're lacking, a lot of transparency on the decision making processes.
Education faces an uncertain future in California. With school budgets already stretched, Governor Jerry Brown has threatened to cut nearly $5 billion more if voters reject his plans to raise taxes. Brown says the tax hike is necessary to meet a budget shortfall and plans to put the proposals to a vote in November.
What's happening in San Leandro right now is it just mirrors all the other problems that are happening statewide and countrywide. So, you know, I'm hoping that people will take cues from what they're doing here.
The hunger strikers called off their protest on Tuesday night, when the school board appeared to agree that the reserves could be used. While Veronica Manduhano welcomed the apparent victory, she was skeptical about the board's intentions.
Like we said, we wanted the school board members to announce that they would use the reserves because last week they said that they could not use them. However, this week they announced that they have been using them the entire year. So that makes me very concerned about the information that they're giving us, whether it's true or not.
After a week without food, 17-year-old Kayla Eli was tired but said that the fight would continue and that the hunger strike was suspended, not ended. She issued an ultimatum to officials.
Before May, if we don't see any results, we'll go back on the hunger strike. And we'll take everyone that said they'll be with us. If they really want to test it, we'll come back 100 times stronger.
Students and staff want to see if the school board lives up to their promises to use the reserve money. In the meantime, they hope more people will join their campaign. George Lavender, FSRN, San Leandro, California.
Much attention this week has focused on the massacre of 16 Afghan civilians by a US soldier. As details continue to emerge, and many in Afghanistan call for the accused to be tried in their country, commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal looks at another massacre committed by US soldiers and the lack of justice for the crimes.
Son of Haditha. For those in on the carnage, that is the Iraq War, the term Haditha tells it all. Haditha is not a person, it is a place. A village in Iraq where U.S. soldiers went on tilt, killing several dozen Iraqis, men, women, and babies. The Haditha massacre happened 6 years ago, but it wasn't formally resolved until several weeks ago when an American sergeant, Frank Wuterich, got off virtually scot-free. Charges against most were dropped, and one soldier won acquittal. To call it a whitewash would be an understatement. It seems that now that a formal U.S. troop withdrawal has been declared, there is no longer a need for the PR of seeming to have a fair trial when Americans kill innocent Iraqis. If anybody believed Americans went to Iraq to help them, Haditha erases that lie. Within weeks of Haditha's resolution, one U.S. soldier goes on tilt in Afghanistan, spraying civilians, going house to house, killing some 16 people at least. As in Iraq, so in Afghanistan, an imperial army invades, armed with words like democracy, human rights, women's rights, and stopping torture. Then Haditha happens. Then Abu Ghraib happens. Then Kabul happens. In fact, empire happened. And we are all watching its degeneration as we speak. Afghanistan, Iraq. Is Iran next? From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
That's it for today's program and for the week. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor, Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Kansas City, standing in for Dorian Marina, I'm Danny Wood.